IB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
A big line is made between riyaza and ruhbaniyya. Mm-hmm. I mean, asceticism or ascesis and monasticism, Brother Alavian. Yeah. So why these two must not be mixed with each other and why? Especially based on Mullah Sadra teachings, you know, ruhbaniyya is, we can say, prevented in Islam, isn't it? Yeah. So why is it so?
Prior to Mullah Sadra, Islamic teachings tells us that we have been prevented from being isolated from society. Because
so monasticism Islam, is this, to be isolated only from the society?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So Rahbani has been avoided from practicing Rahbani or monasticism.
That's right.
Well, since Islam is a multifaceted religion, so actually cares for different aspects of life of a human being in this world. One aspect of human life in this world is social, social contacts with the people, or because we have some crucial dimensions in our lives: our relation with Allah Subhanahu wa Taala, our relations with others, with people, with society, our relation with the environment, mm-hmm. and our relation with ourselves. Mm-hmm. So these four key dimensions have been defined in Islam and Islamic teachings. So we have a duty, we have sort of a commitment towards the society and the people.
That's right.
I mean, the kind of narrations that actually recommends us to be kind to your neighbor.
Yes.
It seems that even there is nothing more important than the neighbor in the world. You see how important this concept is in the view of Islam, that your neighbor, you have some duties towards your neighbor. So the same duties are going to apply for the people around, I mean, in your vicinity. So who is your neighbor? At least 40, I mean, houses next to your area.
All right.
This is the least thing. Again, your neighbor in your workspace, the neighbor in your, I don't know, lots of interpretation for this neighborhood.
Yes.
So when we have all these duties, can we be, I mean, apart from the society? Definitely no. So this is what Islam actually makes Islam different from others. Mm-hmm. Islam tells us that you need some time to be alone with yourself,
yes.
to work on your own soul.
Yes.
But this is not going to be the whole day of yours, the whole night of yours. So you have a duty for others. It is, I mean, a limited time for yourself. Uh-huh. I mean, to pay attention to what you have done. Mm-hmm. I mean, to do your muhasabah, accountability in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whatever you have done.
That's
so again, in Islamic teachings, we have some recommendations again in order to make this aspect of Islamic teachings more colorful, like what we have been avoided to be in a status of rahbaniyya, but to be in a state of riyadha, in a status of riyadha or ascesis.
Yes.
So when we are in the status of ascesis and we have accepted it, so we need to have to gain some knowledge from Islamic teachings first.
Mm-hmm.
So if we lack this knowledge from Islamic teachings, what would be the outcome? Rahbaniyya.
Okay. Is it possible to reach the level, we can say, of riyaza without sharia?
This is the difference, okay. I'm telling you.
Uh-huh.
Look, if we step in the way of riyaza without the knowledge of sharia,
yes.
knowledge of religion,
okay.
or even acting upon it,
okay.
it would be rahbaniyya. The outcome would be rahbaniyya.
Okay.
So, but if we have gained a good knowledge of aqa'id, of akhlaq, of Islamic ahkams and rulings, then we enter to this world and realm of riyadha, ascesis,
yes.
then it would be the thing that is recommended, that is
so,
desired
right.
for Islam
okay.
and a Muslim as a duty.
All right. So, Shaykh Rouhani, it is possible that a person is deviated through riyadha, isn't it?
Why not, yeah.
Okay, I mean, you put lots of hardships, lots of pressures on your shoulders.
Yeah.
You practice a lot, but at the end of the day, we can say all of them is gone. I mean, you are misled from the right path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala because you could not put it in the framework of taqwa, as Imam Ali alayhi salam puts it.
Yeah, you know, it depends that what is your objective, your purpose
uh-huh.
of practicing riyadha or acting according to riyadha, yeah? If your objective is some worldly affairs mm-hmm. or earthly kind of achievements, then of course this kind of riyadhat are kind of useless riyadhat,
mm-hmm.
because it is just wastage of the energy of time and life. But if your objective is to serve Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to get closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then because Allah's creatures are also have to be served by you,
mm-hmm.
that's why when you achieve some, let's say, achievements spiritually, you have to share it with the others.
Mm-hmm.
You have to help others, yeah? Like prophets, for example, prophets, alayhim salatu wassalam, they have this highest level of, let's say, achievements spiritually. Can we say that they did not care about others?
All right.
They, or the imma alayhim salatu wassalam.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Imam Sajjad, alayhim salatu wassalam.
Yes.
He had many students.
Yes.
And he trained them and he brought them up in accordance to this, let's say, Sharia law, and of course the enhancement of the level of purification in their souls, and also the other imma alayhim salatu wassalam. So that's why we cannot say that this riyadhat should be a kind of completely isolation from the society, from the community, from the people, not caring about others, not helping others, not guiding others. These are the things that we should consider when we talk about
Riyadhat. That's right. As we read in Ayah 40 and 41 of Surah An-Nazi'at, that, but as for him who is ought to stand before his Lord and restrains his soul from following desires, for sure paradise will be his place. That's right. Okay, so controlling desires, satanic temptations, you know, and under the framework of Sharia law, this is the best way in order to do Riyadhat. And on that time, you know, that's right, doing extraordinary by the body is possible, but by the soul is more important, okay? So, and the true meaning of the riyaza is going to happen the scale of the soul rather than the body. Thank you very much, Brother Alavyan and Shaykh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of riyaza to nafs. It was very kind of you.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Please, for more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir to another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanillah. Midstream.
Seventeen months of blood, rubble, and the same headlines playing on loop while the world shrugs and moves on. Gaza is still burning, bodies are still being pulled from under collapsed homes, and families are still being forced to flee the same ruins they tried to rebuild with their bare hands. And what does the world do? It funds more bombs, it buys more weapons, it signs more deals with the very regime committing genocide in broad daylight. Zionist Israel's war machine has bulldozed its way deeper into Gaza, tightening its grip on the so-called Netzarim corridor, splitting the strip into isolated pockets of death and despair. Northern Gaza is an open grave. Southern Gaza is a prison. And Rafah, the supposed last refuge, is now under siege. Israeli occupation tanks are crushing the roads, fighter jets are pounding refugee camps, and entire families are being erased in an instant. A mother and her daughter vaporized in Khan Yunis. Six children obliterated in an airstrike in Gaza City. And still, the UN, the US, and the rest of the so-called civilized world does nothing but offer empty words and lethal silence. Washington claims to support de-escalation while signing billion-dollar arms deals with the very state carrying out these massacres. The Persian Gulf Arab states, drowning in oil money and Western praise, rush to buy more American weapons while intercepting Yemeni missiles that dare to challenge the ongoing slaughter. Arab leaders mumble condemnations as they shake hands with the same officials sanctioning our deaths. It is not just hypocrisy, it is complicity, and it reeks of indifference toward our corpses piling up in the Levant. The resistance, battered but unbroken, continues to fight back. Al-Qassam rockets light up the sky over Ashkelon, a reminder that Gaza will not be erased without a fight. And yet, we have seen this all before, haven't we? The death toll rises, the outrage simmers, the media spins its narrative, and then nothing. Until the next massacre, until the next round of forced displacement, until the next pile of shattered bodies is deemed unworthy of grief. Since last week alone, at least 650 Palestinians have been killed. How many more? How many until the world stops treating us as disposable? How many until our lives matter more than arms deals and political posturing? Or have we already passed that threshold and we are just screaming into the void? 17 months and we are still here, still bleeding, still demanding the world to acknowledge our humanity. But maybe that's the problem. Maybe we never were human to them at all. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Months of relentless war and mass killings, and still Gaza's cries are drowned out by the sound of deals, weapon sales, and political posturing. While entire families are wiped out in Israeli entity airstrikes, Western powers fuel the carnage with silence and complicity. Tonight, we discuss the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the global hypocrisy enabling it, and the resistance refusing to be erased with Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate from the occupied West Bank. It's a pleasure for us to have you with us, Dr. Amal, in these very tough times. Thank you for being with us. Let us begin by the past 17 months where Gaza has endured relentless Israeli entity attacks, forced displacements, and systematic destruction while the world just watches in apathy. As someone witnessing this from the occupied West Bank, how do you assess the long-term impact of this genocide, not just on Gaza, but on the Palestinian struggle as a whole?
Good to be with you, Marwa. Thanks. Look, over the past centuries, the Palestinian people endured the tyranny of several empires. During the last century, they endured wave after wave of aggression by the British colonial army and the Zionist terrorist militia before the and after the 1948 genocidal and ethnic cleansing war, the Nakba. The continuous aggression by the imperial Zionist colonial project in Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, what was the result? The Palestinian and the Lebanese national resistance continued against the invasion, occupation of Lebanon, and the Palestinian resilient people created the 1987 Intifada uprising. And then 1996, 2000, 2002 in Jenin, and they survived five aggressions against our people in Gaza and 17 years of continuous blockade. And the regional of resistance formed a ring surrounding the U.S. Zionist military base in Palestine. Later on, we have October 7 operation of Al-Aqsa flood, mm-hmm. which erupted and ignited the arms resistance in the West Bank. Jenin in particular, Tulkarem, Nablus, all over the West Bank and Jerusalem, and was supported by the Lebanese resistance of Hezbollah, the Syria before HDS took over, mm-hmm. the Iraqis and the Yemenis and the Iranians. Now the Palestinian resistance and the people have gained the international support like never before. Millions of people around the globe are chanting, free, free Palestine, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. This global support has ignited more challenge to the U.S. and Western governments and shaking their mere foundations. The people of the world now realize that the liberation of Palestine shall also set them free from the tyranny of their own political systems.
Well, Dr. Wahdan, the Israeli occupation has solidified its military grip over Gaza, particularly through what they call the Netzarim Corridor, while intensifying its bombardments on civilian areas. Given this ongoing military expansion, do you really believe that Zionist Israel is preparing for a full-scale reoccupation of Gaza, as some Israeli entity media is suggesting at the moment? And if so, what are the consequences of such a move, or is it just now Israel working on its own, no one dares to say a word?
Well, I think this is all only media game. They're trying to pressure the Palestinian resistance and the people, not only in Gaza, also in historic Palestine. The Zionist project reached its peak, and even their strategists realize very well that they are facing an existential threat. That 17 months of heroic Palestinian resistance and steadfastness, and the support by the Axis of Resistance, and of course international solidarity, made it harder for the U.S. Zionist tyranny regime to continue the genocidal aggression and illusions of ethnic cleansing. They know very well that reoccupying Gaza will cost them a lot militarily and economically, taking into consideration the fatal loss they are facing or they have faced during the 17 continuous months of aggression. They are facing real problems now drafting more people into the army, resignations of their officers, the revolt within even the military reserve power. The domestic front is facing lots of problems, lack of confidence of their political, military, and security leadership. The opposition to Netanyahu policy is increasing. The exit migration rate is also increasing. Occupying Gaza might be their fatal strategy. Mm-hmm. We can say the same about Trump and Netanyahu's ethnic cleansing. They are actually out of line, and we know that all empires face this same problem when they reach their peak before they start declining and before they collapse.
Well, Dr. Wahdan, while the United States and its allies, they continue to arm Zionist Israel, we see the Persian Gulf Arab states are not only normalizing relations, but actively intercepting Yemeni missiles that are meant to challenge continuous Israeli entity genocide on Gaza. How do you view the role of these Arab regimes in the broader context of the war on Gaza, and what does this mean for Palestinian resistance moving forward?
First of all, we have to salute the Yemeni air forces and the Yemeni army and Ansarullah for their support, continuous support, even though the Axis of Resistance have endured a real problem during the past 3 months. But the Yemenis had stood fast in their position in supporting the Palestinian people and the Lebanese people, in supporting the Palestinian resistance and the Lebanese resistance. Actually, we know that the Gulf states were created by the British colonial power to serve its interests. They are functional entities who, by their structure, cannot survive independently without or away from any superpower, although they have the chance or were given the chance to be part of the Eastern Bloc, to go towards the East. And they are started to move, but cannot take this decision on their own. The Trump administration, as we know Trump, I mean, this personality of colonial thinking and ideology of hegemony and disrespectful of leaders of the world, we've seen it in different areas. We've seen how he acted towards Europe, for example, which is their ally, towards members in the NATO. Trump has been forced to take a position against the NATO now. They want to withdraw from the NATO. So we know that we cannot, as Arab countries, we cannot depend on Trump. We cannot depend on any American administration. We've seen what happened to Afghanistan. We've seen what happened to Vietnam before. So putting all their eggs in the American or U.S. Basket, it's not the right way to go. If they want to survive, they have to take another step. Taking a step backward from normalizing with the Israeli entity, because they're going to face a real problem even with this policy of normalizing relationships with the Israeli colonial system. They're going to be another victim of the vicious and hegemony policy of the U.S. and Zionist regime. They should take a very courageous step and go away from this alliance with the U.S. Otherwise,
they're
going to
be next. Well, I hope they listen to your advice. I hope they do listen to your advice. Thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate from the occupied West Bank, for joining us to talk about the ongoing crisis and genocide, basically, in the Gaza Strip at the hands of Zionist Israel with weapons made by the United States of America. Thank you very much for your time and effort. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the Yemeni resilience against U.S. aggression.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In the face of escalating U.S. military aggression, Yemen's Ansarullah movement continues to resist, proving that even against the mightiest superpowers, true victory lies in independence and defiance. As the U.S. intensifies its military presence in the region, Yemen's leaders vow to support Gaza and push back against external interference. More details in the following report. The brilliance of Ansarullah, like all resistance movements, lies in its remarkable ability to challenge the world's superpowers, forces that must dare not provoke or defy, and to prove its strength by achieving what can only be defined as true victory, gaining independence and thwarting any external force from imposing its will on Yemen's internal affairs. Currently, Yemen finds itself at the center of an intense confrontation. In mid-March, U.S. President Donald Trump announced heavy airstrikes on the country following the State Department's designation of Ansarullah as a global terrorist organization. This move was seen as fulfilling one of Trump's early promises made upon taking office. The U.S. swiftly deployed aircraft carriers, including the USS Carl Vinson, to the Middle East, intensifying its military presence while prolonging the deployment of the USS Harry S. Truman off Yemen's coast. What drove Trump to take such drastic steps? Firstly, to present himself as stronger than his predecessor, Joe Biden, by showcasing U.S. military might in the region. The presence of two American aircraft carriers and an escalation of military operations sends a clear message. Trump intends to protect Zionist Israel and control vital international trade routes, all while trying to manipulate U.S. public opinion with the image of strength. Secondly, Trump's actions align with the far-right Israeli entity agenda, which seeks to destabilize the region by targeting resistance movements that support the Palestinian cause. Thirdly, there is a strategic calculation to irritate China. The Bab el-Mandeb Strait, a critical trade artery, serves as a conduit for $160 billion U.S. dollars in Chinese exports annually, with 60% of its goods heading to Europe. By controlling this checkpoint, the U.S. aims to apply pressure on Beijing in future negotiations. However, Yemen's response to the U.S. aggression has been nothing short of defiant. Ansarullah's leaders wasted no time announcing that military operations against Israeli entity ships operating in the Arabian and Red Seas would resume. As the U.S. launched its strikes, Yemen's missiles and drones successfully targeted U.S. warships and even hit Tel Aviv, forcing Israeli entity settlers and regime officials into shelters. This is part of a broader effort by Yemen to support Gaza, a mission they pledged to continue until the siege on Gaza is lifted and the U.S. ceases its aggression. Despite the overwhelming military might of the U.S., the war has not shifted Yemen's stance. Instead, it has showcased Ansarullah's strategic ingenuity,
using asymmetric tactics and advanced missile technology, such as the Tufan missile, with a range of over 1,600 kilometers to strike targets far beyond Yemen's borders. The U.S. may boast unparalleled military strength, but Yemen's resilience, bolstered by a deeply rooted sense of duty and formidable terrain, has set the stage for what could be a prolonged conflict. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Al-Zubaydi, Yemeni political commentator. It's a pleasure having you with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, how has Ansarullah's strategic use of asymmetric warfare and advanced missile technology like the Tufan missile allow it to effectively challenge the very overwhelmingly military power of the United States of America and Zionist Israel? And what impact does this have on maybe the broader resistance movement in the region?
Thank you for having me. In truth, Yemen has redefined the rules of engagement in this battle, Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, through its asymmetric warfare strategy, with surprise being the key element of critical importance. Yemen has also demonstrated exceptional boldness and tactical ingenuity, adopting a distinct strategic approach in confronting this aggression, particularly against its primary adversary, the United States. Another crucial factor has been the low-cost nature of Yemen's operations. It has managed to challenge the U.S. with minimal expenses, using low-cost drones to target warships, naval vessels, and even aircraft carriers, as well as deploying missiles with advanced capabilities that can evade maritime defense radars. However, the most important element is faith. We firmly believe that victory is both a divine craft and a human will. Yemen entered this confrontation fully aware of the high costs and sacrifices, yet it does not fixate on immediate outcomes, but rather on the principles that drive its struggle. These principles are deeply rooted in faith and morality, which is why Yemen does not concern itself with conventional power balances. Instead, it has shattered the status quo of deterrence. Today, even American officials acknowledge their failure to halt Yemen's morally driven and steadfast support for Gaza. This growing American failure is evident in the incapacity of their aircraft carriers. For instance, the USS Harry S. Truman is under constant attack, along with its accompanying naval units, exerting significant pressure on the United States. This pressure is reflected in Trump's recent statement about sending another aircraft carrier, a clear sign of the failure of previous deployments, which have proven ineffective. We recall that in the initial phase of U.S. intervention, Washington dispatched four aircraft carriers, none of which succeeded. Instead, they resorted to a strategy of retreat in the face of Yemen's military tactics and resilience. These developments only strengthen the confidence and resolve of the axis of resistance. The primary objective for both the Zionist entity and the U.S. has been to project an image of victory. Until the very last moment, the Zionists have claimed to have achieved security and altered the strategic landscape, insisting that they have weakened the axis of resistance in specific areas. However, Yemen's intervention has disrupted this narrative, striking deep within the Zionist entity and imposing new equations. One of these new realities is that Ben Gurion Airport is no longer secure. We have witnessed the intensity of strikes reaching the heart of the Israeli entity, shattering the illusion of security. Today, security is unattainable within the Zionist entity. Tel Aviv is no longer safe, and Ben Gurion Airport is no longer a reliable hub for air travel. We have also seen major international airlines reconsidering their flights to Tel Aviv. These significant shifts will undoubtedly serve as a source of strength and momentum for the axis of resistance moving forward.
Well, there's a very important question that I want to ask here, Mr. Mohammed. While the U.S. is focused on protecting Zionist Israel and controlling key maritime trade routes through the Bab al-Mandeb and the Red Sea, how long can Yemen continue to resist under these constant U.S. airstrikes to protect its territory and to remain loyal to the Palestinian cause?
Until the very last breath, I assure you, Yemen has entered this battle with unwavering conviction in the sanctity and significance of its stance. It has not engaged arbitrarily or recklessly, as some claim. This is not a Yemeni gamble or an uncalculated adventure. On the contrary, Yemen fully comprehends the magnitude of the sacrifices required and is prepared to endure them at every level. Yemen understands that failing to take a firm and escalating position at this stage would be a grave mistake. As Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi emphasized in his recent speech, this phase demands the highest levels of escalation. He made it clear that Yemen will escalate further because the moment calls for it, whether in response to the Zionist entity's renewed aggression on Gaza or the arrogant language of American threats against Yemen. Trump has spoken of bringing hell upon Yemen, of deploying deadly and crushing force, but Yemen remains steadfast, fully aware of the weight of its stance and the sacred duty it upholds. This awareness is rooted in an unshakable faith, Sayed al-Houthi has previously stated that if the Americans truly understood the depth of Yemen's faith-driven position, they would alter their own strategy. It is this faith that binds Yemen to its commitment, to remain resolute, to stand firm. The facts on the ground and the historical record confirm Yemen's unwavering stance, one that will not waver. Yemen will continue to stand with Gaza. It will never accept the isolation of Gaza, nor will it allow any faction of the axis of resistance to stand alone. The same was true in Lebanon. Yemen made it clear, you are not alone. Whether it is Hezbollah or the Lebanese people, they are not alone. Yemen will remain steadfast in this struggle until its very last breath. We fully recognize the costs and the sacrifices will be immense, yet our trust in Allah remains absolute. This unwavering faith, rooted in divine consciousness and Quranic awareness, fortifies our resolve and affirms that Yemen will stay on this path until the very end, God willing. We firmly believe in one of the inevitable promises outlined in the Quran, the certainty of victory over these enemies, by the will of Allah Almighty.
Well, President Trump has consistently accused Ansarullah of being Iranian proxies, warning that Iran will be his next target. Why is the U.S. so insistent on linking Yemen to Iran in the same way it targets Hezbollah in Lebanon? And how would Ansarullah react if the U.S. actually, and Zionist Israel, decide to escalate their aggression and target Iran?
From the very beginning, the United States has sought to sever the Islamic Republic of Iran as the spearhead of the axis of resistance from the peoples and forces within this alliance. If you recall, one of the key American conditions in the previous Iranian nuclear deal was for Iran to completely detach itself from the axis. Iran, however, categorically rejected this demand. Now, as discussions about a potential new nuclear agreement resurface, there is no doubt that the United States is once again pushing for this condition. Yet, the Islamic Republic remains firm in its refusal, viewing its moral, ethical, and ideological commitment to the axis as paramount, not as a matter of Iranian national interest alone, but as a commitment to the entire Ummah. From Yemen's perspective, there is nothing to be ashamed of in this relationship. On the contrary, we take pride in it. By the grace of Allah, we openly declare that our ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran are a source of honor. We are aligned with the spearhead of global support for the oppressed, the backbone of resistance against American and Zionist hegemony, and all forces of arrogance. Trump frequently repeats the claim that every bullet fired in Yemen is an Iranian bullet. This serves two purposes. First, it is an attempt to diminish Yemen's growing military power and strategic effectiveness, something that deeply unsettles both the United States and the Zionist entity. Second, it lays the groundwork for a potential future justification for aggression against Iran. Recently, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei made a critical point, particularly directed at the Americans, when he stated that describing the forces and nations of the Axis as mere pawns or proxies of Iran is a strategic miscalculation. And indeed, this assessment is entirely accurate. Viewing Yemen as nothing more than an extension of Iran is a grave strategic mistake. Yemen's struggle is driven by the will of its own people, independent, sovereign, and unwavering in its decisions. We are now in a critical phase, one defined by the erosion of American hegemony. The United States is making a monumental strategic mistake by attempting to downplay Yemen's rising power, a power that has shattered the illusion of American invincibility, not just on land, but in the seas as well. The mere presence of American military forces in the region has become a liability, as Yemen's relentless strikes on aircraft carriers and naval assets continue to impose heavy costs. Thus, we stand at the threshold of a new era, an era marked by the dismantling of American dominance. And as Washington scrambles for an exit, it clings to the tired narrative of Iranian proxies and pawns. But as Sayyid Khamenei rightfully pointed out, this is nothing more than a strategic blunder of historic proportions.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Al-Zubaydi, political commentator, for joining us to talk about these pressing matters right here. Ladies and gents, please do follow us to get more updates about the region of West Asia right here on the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir. iranradio.ir.
IRIB English Radio presents The Month of Allah. Let's be with Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
As I look to nature's beauty, dazzled am I, knowing everything calls on you, the Lord Most High.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen Wassalatu wassalam ala ashrafil anbiya'i wal mursaleen Sayyidina Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Welcome to the program Month of Allah. During the month of Ramadan, we have been enjoying worshipping God Almighty. And besides worshipping Him, there are other duties that we have. That is duties to the creation of God. And of those duties to the creation of God is the duties that we have to our brothers. When we think about one of the reasons why our 12th Imam doesn't reappear, Imam Zaman, one of the factors that we can maybe say is that the community, the nation, the Ummah is not ready for him. Therefore, we have to make ourselves prepared and ready. Therefore, bringing back Imam Zaman, bringing back the 12th Imam, is not only limited to an individual effort. It should be a collective effort. It is an effort that we, as a community, as brothers, that we grow spiritually, that we are very careful of each other's rights, that we will take care of their financial needs if they need money. If they are true brother, we will help them. If they need our time, we will help them. Therefore, Islam is not a religion that only limits us to our worship between us and God. That we understand that connecting to God, especially in the month of Ramadan, also is tied with the way we treat people. One of the traditions that we have from Imam Baqir alayhi salam, and it is a question that many people have when they read history, that how come the imams didn't uprise against the corrupt governments of their times? In one of these traditions, it answers this question. They come to Imam Baqir alayhi salam. As you know, Imam Baqir, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, they were a little bit more free than the rest of the imams in Medina. So they asked him, they asked Imam Baqir alayhi salam, how come you don't uprise? They tell him, in Kufa, there's a large group, and if you command them, we will obey you and we'll follow you. We have a large army is waiting for you. A large amount of people are waiting for you. And the Imam answers to them. He says, in this tradition from Al-Ikhtisas, ask them, do all of them come to their brothers' wallets and take whatever they have and need? Are they so close that they can take somebody's money? They can come to their wallet or where they stash their money or where they hold their money. And can they take whatever they need? Are they that close to each other? Do they basically take care of the financial situation of their own brothers? And then they say, فَقَالَ لَا. They said, no, they don't. Then the Imam says something very interesting. And from this, we understand that what is our duty. It says, فَقَالَ فَهُمْ بِدَمَائِهِمْ أَبْخَلَ. That they are more stingy when it comes to their blood. You're saying they're willing to sacrifice for me, they're willing to uprise against, say, a strong government. They're not willing to even spend their money for Islam, let alone giving their blood for Islam, for example. Therefore, we understand that the duties that we have, that Imam Baqir alayhi salam in this tradition is saying that mu'mins should be so close. Brothers should be so close that they can even go to each other's wallet and the person is satisfied. I took, say, $5, $10, $20, you know, however much I needed, I took from your wallet. This is how close the brothers should be. And this is how we should prepare ourselves for the coming back of our Imam. That we need to have a tight community. We need to be friendly with everybody. We need to take care of whatever needs they have. When someone comes into our mosque or to our centers, we need to approach them, talk to them, and we need to even sacrifice our time, sacrifice our money for them. This is what the Imam wants. And this is what makes God happy, and this is what makes the Prophet happy and the Ahlul Bayt happy. When we look at another tradition, a man was a farmer, and he was taxed heavily. And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam wanted to help him. So he wrote a letter to a person that had a position in the government and said to him, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wrote to him, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Surra akhaka sarraka Allah. Make your brother happy, make your brother pleased, and you will have made Allah pleased. So this person takes this letter, takes it to the person that was in charge, had a governmental position, and says to him, basically, you know, I need help. I have this much money I owe in taxes. So this person that loved Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, because of the connection between Imam al-Sadiq and his followers, he gives the utmost respect to this person. He takes that letter and puts it on his eyes and takes from his own money and repays the taxes that that person owed. And says, the next year you owe taxes too, he pays that next year too. And then he says, well, this is the rug that the letter of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq has reached me. These are your rugs. Do you need an animal for you to ride, say a horse or any animal for you to ride? He gives them an animal to ride. Then the person becomes very happy and comes back to Imam al-Sadiq. And Imam al-Sadiq tells him this. He sees that he is very happy. Imam Sadiq says, Wallah laqad sarra Allah wa rasulah. I swear by God, this person, he has made you happy, he has made Allah happy, and he has made his messenger happy. So brothers and sisters, when we are helping each other, helping the needy, helping those that need, say, a skill that we have, time that we have, when we are helping them, we are helping Allah. We are making Allah happy. We're making the messenger of Allah happy. And this is how we make we solidify our community and we become stronger. And this is how we become a strong nation, and that one day, inshallah, we can help and make our 12th Imam reappear by doing collective work, that by making each other, inshallah, grow spiritually and grow in tighter bonds with each other in this month of Ramadan.
قال الإمام علي عليه السلام أحب الأعمال إلى الله عز وجل في الأرض الدعاء.
Imam Ali عليه السلام said, "The most beloved action on this earth with Allah, mighty and exalted, is supplication."
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله ما لنا رب سوى
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله ما لنا رب سوى
April 10th, 2024, Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, attended Eid al-Fitr prayer. The prayer is the most important religious aid of Muslims after a month of fasting. Ayatollah Khamenei talked about the certainty of punishing the Israeli regime. All military experts admitted that the Iranian leader's warning will be carried out. There were many speculations regarding how it would be fulfilled. Iran would soon show the world its might. It all happened at a time when the U.S. martyred the Iranian national hero and top anti-terrorist command. Ayatollah Khamenei stated, Israel's attack on Iran's embassy in Damascus was tantamount to an attack on Iranian territory. This declaration prompted some officials in the Israeli ruling party to deny any involvement in the attack. Analysts believe Iran would harm the interests of the Israeli regime through its allies and scattered battles. Others believe that Iran might attack one of Israel's diplomatic centers, potentially choosing a weaker country in the region like Jordan. Consequently, Israel began evacuating its diplomatic missions, which were considered possible targets. The U.S. had a different perspective. It believed Iran was deliberately positioning missiles in view of spy satellites to send a message to hostile countries that the attack will originate from the Islamic Republic's territory. If this speculation was accurate, how severe could Iran's attack be? Since the Second Arab-Israeli War, no country had targeted the Israeli regime. When Iraq, under Saddam, faced the first U.S. attack in 1990, it fired 11 missiles at Israel, all of which were thwarted. Most of Yemen's cruise missiles were also intercepted over the last 5 months.
We cannot say for certain what these missiles and drones were targeting, but they were launched from Yemen, heading north along the Red Sea, potentially towards targets in
Israel. Now, Iran was considering attacking targets 2,000 kilometers beyond its borders. But was this feasible, and what would be the retaliation from Israel? Turkey, Iran's northwestern neighbor, not only produces and owns anti-ballistic and anti-cruise defense systems, but also has special NATO systems. Former U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland stated that Turkey should have the highest defense capabilities. This means Iran had to deal with a defense system in the northwest. To the west, Iran is bordered by Iraq, which was occupied by the United States. On January 20, 2020, Iran destroyed large Ain al-Assad base with missiles in response to the assassination of Major General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of Iran's Quds Force.
Well, words can't even describe the amount of energy that is released by these missiles.
Rocket launches were conducted after Iraqi authorities were given a heads up 20 minutes before the firing, and likely the U.S. was also informed of the attack, but no defensive move was made against the missiles. 1 month later, on March 30th, 2020, BBC Farsi reported the U.S. Army has deployed the Patriot anti-missile system in some bases in Iraq to protect its forces from possible attacks by Iran and its allies. Agence France-Presse also reported on March 30th, quoting anonymous sources, that one of the systems was sent to Ain al-Assad base in western Iraq last week and is currently being prepared. Thus, the Patriot systems based in Iraq will be the first defense barrier against Iran. Moreover, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have had open relationships with Israel for some time. Even when Yemen disrupted the transfer of goods from the Red Sea to Israel, the UAE and Saudi Arabia provided a free land route for goods to Jordan and from Jordan to Israeli-occupied territories. NATO's military capability should also be considered. Besides the U.S. and certain Arab states along the Persian Gulf, France and the U.K. would now also be part of the system defending Israel. Meanwhile, Israel uses a wide range of systems to counter attacks, from ballistic missiles with trajectories carrying them high into the atmosphere to cruise missiles and surface-to-surface rockets. Israel's Iron Dome system has often made headlines since the regime's military operation in Gaza in response to the Hamas-led operation of the 7th of October. But can this system, which has not been tested against any real or serious attack, be Israel's last layer of defense? At the highest level of defense, Israel uses the Arrow 1 and Arrow 2 anti-missile systems, cutting-edge technology from the U.S. The radar consists of four components: the Arrow interceptor missile, the Green Pine radar, Communication Control Command Center, and Launch Control Center. The system also uses the American Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, system, and is movable. The radar can detect 30 targets at very high altitudes while traveling over 9 times the speed of sound. They claim that the newer version of the system can track ballistic missiles up to a range of 600 kilometers. The system calculates the ballistic trajectory of launched missiles and destroys them when they are on its path. The Arrow intercepts missiles in the uppermost layer of the atmosphere or beyond to prevent the spread of chemical or nuclear materials over occupied territories. On October 31, 2023, Israel claimed to have destroyed Yemen's long-range ballistic missile, and on November 9, Arrow 3, Israel's most advanced anti-missile system, reportedly intercepted a Yemeni medium-range missile near the port of Eilat. Each Arrow system contains 2 to 8 missiles and takes an hour to reload. At a lower layer is the David Sling missile system, designed to counter missiles with a range of 70 to 300 kilometers, including Hezbollah's Katyushas, Qassam rockets, and Iran's tactical missiles. the system cost about $2 billion funded by American taxpayers to protect Israel. David Sling is designed to intercept and destroy targets at altitudes ranging from several meters to 15 kilometers above the ground, even if the targets travel at speeds up to 7 times the speed of sound. The radar range of David Sling exceeds 470 kilometers. The system contains 12 missiles and is capable of engaging ballistic missiles. Each David Sling missile costs $1 million and functions by directly hitting the attacking missile. In the final stage, there's the Iron Dome. Each rocket costs $50 million and each missile costs $20,000. The Iron Dome is designed to shoot down targets such as mortars and rockets, which are often fired from Lebanon and Gaza. It is supposed to be most useful for protecting the cities near Gaza, as a large number of low-cost rockets are launched from the Gaza side. There are also THAAD and Patriot systems between Iran and occupied territories. THAAD combines features of all other systems and can engage targets at all altitudes. It is the exclusive interceptor for the United States and NATO. THAAD can intercept any target up to a range of 1,000 kilometers. The radar has 2 search modes, forward base and terminal base. In forward mode, the base is installed near the borders of the hostile country to estimate the direction of the missiles immediately after they are fired. A radar of this type has been installed in Turkey with another one in the occupied territories. In base mode, the radar is responsible for detecting and guiding anti-missile systems up to a range of 1,000 kilometers. When THAAD is linked with a satellite, its range increases significantly. Furthermore, the Patriot system is located between Iran and Israel. The optimized Patriot has a missile with a smaller warhead that can reach higher altitudes, about 20 kilometers. The Patriot system forms a large dome next to THAAD, which has a range of 200 kilometers. Before the first Persian Gulf War, THAAD and the Patriot systems had not been tested on the ground. When Saddam Hussein started using Al-Hussein and Al-Abbas ballistic missiles, then U.S. President George Bush claimed they had intercepted 39 of the 40 missiles fired. However, on February 25, 1991, one of these missiles hit the Dahran base in Saudi Arabia, killing 28 U.S. soldiers. The U.S. president and military were concealing a secret. The Patriot system was supposed to distinguish whether a missile was fired at a sensitive target or towards the desert, and would not fire it if there was no danger. This system wasn't 100% effective, and as a result, only 25 of the 88 missiles fired by Iraq were intercepted. The Patriot system did not engage the rest. After the 1991 invasion, the United Nations banned Iraq from continuing its long-range missile program. However, in 2003, former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein secretly decided to build a missile with a range of 150 kilometers. That year, he acquired 2 tactical missiles. Previously, Iraq used Scud missiles, which were modified into Al-Hussein and Al-Abbas missiles by combining 2 Scuds. The Al-Abbas missile was intended to have a range of 1,000 kilometers, but failed, and the project was abandoned after the first Persian Gulf War. In 2003, the new missiles did not work, and the U.S. destroyed all of them after occupying Iraq. Iraq then built the Al-Samud missile, but it did not achieve satisfactory results. These were low-quality rockets intended to be combined with a few remaining rockets from the war. The Patriot system was the most successful among them, meaning Iran had to face the most complex defense system.